Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, honoring Veronica Garibay and Phoebe Seaton, 2020 recipients of a James Irvine Foundation Leadership Award. Watch a video about their work at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. On today's show, we check in on an ambitious community-led program to improve the Valley's air. What's the progress 18 months in? And you probably know her as a panelist on NPR's hit quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But there's a lot more to comedian Paula Poundstone than Bluff the Listener and Lightning Fill in the Blank. We catch up with her before her stand-up show in Fresno Saturday. But first, with California's March primary less than 2 weeks away, let's turn to politics. The race to represent the 16th Congressional District is heating up between incumbent Jim Costa and fellow Democrat Esmeralda Soria, thanks in part to a couple of attention-grabbing television ads from the Costa campaign. I sat down with both candidates to discuss the commercials and many of the key issues facing the district. First, we'll hear from Soria, who, in addition to her role as president of the Fresno City Council, also sits on a governor-appointed task force to address homelessness. Our conversation starts there.
What we have done over the last 9 months as part of the task force, we came up with a set of recommendations and a set of best practices, highlighting what has been good in the various local municipalities, what has worked. But just like Fresno, you know, the issue is very complicated. I will say that I am proud of where Fresno City and County. You know, for a long time, people complained about us not having low barrier shelter. And so in this last the first round with dollars that came from the governor, we were able to, for the first time, establish those low barrier shelters. And people may say, well, there's the Poverello House and the Rescue Mission. However, even the Rescue Mission wasn't considered a low barrier shelter. When we're talking about low barrier shelter, we're talking about people being able to come in with their pets, possessions, and partners. And that wasn't the reality. It's come as you are. And what we're doing now in the shelters that we've established here in the city of Fresno is that we are wrapping people with the services that they need, making an assessment to try to create a plan so that they can navigate the system and eventually would lead them to permanent housing.
But of course, you're running for Congress. What does the federal government need to do to support the efforts on the local level?
Well, you know, that's a great question. So we receive very little funding that comes from the federal government. A city like Fresno of our size gets not even $1 million in homelessness dollars. So what can you really do with less than $1 million? So we really need to increase our federal investments. The other thing with the federal government, we need to increase our permanent housing for affordability from the federal government. The city of Fresno, again, only receives about $1 million to $2 million a year when it comes for affordable housing. And we know how expensive it is to build one unit. We're saying maybe $400,000 to $500,000 for one unit. So that means that in 1 year, we would essentially be building four units. We wouldn't be able to build ourselves out of this problem. So we definitely need to leverage resources from the state and federal government. The city of Fresno also has a responsibility to have some skin in the game. From day one, when I came on this council, I have been advocating for us to set aside monies from our general fund to begin to develop a housing trust fund. And so the first year I was not successful, unfortunately, but over the last couple of years, we've been able to set aside some dollars. So in this year's budget, we have seen some set asides, and there is now a willingness to build this housing trust fund, which many other big cities have already done, and they are leveraging serious amount of dollars from the state of California when it comes to building affordable housing. And that's going to be the long-term solution.
So let's move on to immigration. Is there a realistic path forward toward immigration reform? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, we definitely know that our system is outdated and broken. I support comprehensive immigration reform. In kind of my previous life, I went to law school, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be an immigration attorney because I do come from parents that came to this country as immigrants, and I saw the struggles that they had. It wasn't until 1986, during the Ronald Reagan era, that they were able to adjust their status. And so we know that there are 12 million Americans in this nation living without status today, and thousands of them are residing here in the Valley and are really the backbone of our agricultural industry. So we have to do something. And we have to make sure that we're protecting our dreamers. Yes, there was the Deferred Action Program that was proposed and issued by President Obama. But we know that this program has been under attack from the time that President Trump came on board. And so we need to assure these young dreamers that are living here in our communities that they're going to be protected. In the long term, we need a real comprehensive immigration reform. We need to make sure that the people that are here living in our community come out of the shadows, and that we give them a pathway to citizenship. But we also have to fix the outdated visa system that we have. My father, as a U.S. citizen, applied for my auntie, who has been living in Mexico her entire life. She's been waiting in the quote-unquote line for 20 years. So the system that we have in place is not working for our current economy. And we have to also address the issues abroad that are impacting the inflow of immigration coming into our country.
Your opponent, Jim Acosta, is campaigning on his efforts to increase water supplies and clean up contaminated groundwater. He has a long track record in the Valley on those issues. Why would voters select you over your opponent?
Well, one of the things that I will tell you, he's focused his water efforts on the ag industry. What he has failed to advocate for is for true safe water drinking solutions for farm workers. You know, what surprises me is that, you know, he's been in office 16 years, and yet our neighboring congressman, TJ Cox, just this year introduced safe drinking water legislation. I'm wondering, why wouldn't our representative introduce that 16 years ago?
Currently, Acosta is running campaign ads that critique you on a number of points. I would like to give you an opportunity to respond. First, about the claims made about your income. In 2018, you voted to increase Fresno City Council salaries by 23%. And then there was the comment that followed that you made to the Fresno Bee that you live paycheck to paycheck. What is your response?
You know, I will say that I was very disappointed by Jim's response. It was a very Trump-like response. It is not focused on the real issues, and that he actually mocked an issue that is impacting families across the Valley. It's no secret. I've been very transparent about my situation. In today's world, I am that former student that racked up six figures in college debt, and I'm not embarrassed to talk about it. I still owe today $150,000. I pay more in student loan payments every month than my mortgage. So if you just add that up, that leaves me with a very small amount as disposable income. I talked about it on Facebook because someone criticized me, and I said, guess what? I have a dog. I don't have kids, but I have a dog. My dog got sick. I took him to the vet. It cost me $400 that visit. So if you think about my situation, I don't compare it to some of the working families that make less. I feel for them because they're in a worse situation that any crisis could lead them into homelessness or bankrupt. That is what people are experiencing in today's age. And it's sad to see that rather than focus on the issues of poverty, how we're going to uplift working families, he resorts to Trump-like attacks to distract voters from what is the real issue. You know, it was very interesting because I got tons of calls from our African-American pastors, from I spoke to Dolores Huerta, who's one of my supporters, and they just found it very disappointing that he would mock an issue that is impacting the majority of people that live in the Valley.
So another thing that was referenced in the ad was your fiance. They didn't reference him by name, but you are, of course, engaged to Terrence Frazier, a local developer that does a lot of business with the city. Can you speak to your personal investment in his businesses?
Well, I've been very transparent from the beginning. People can go look at my forms. I've never voted on anything related to his business because we are conflicted from that, and just to be in full transparency. the fact is that he's been doing business in the city long before I was elected into office. He's been a very successful entrepreneur, one of the most successful African-American entrepreneurs in this community. You know, he has his own record of being successful without my help. And it was a majority of the council that actually, and not me, that supported whatever work he's done with the city of Fresno.
Some in the Democratic Party have expressed frustration that you are taking on a congressman who has been an incumbent for so long. Speak to why you jumped into this race.
Well, I'll go back to my personal experience. My father last year was forced to retire because my mother has Alzheimer's, and she's been on this trajectory for 5 years. And what I realized was that my parents have worked so hard, played by the rules, and are relying on a very fragile safety net system that continues to be under attack. Those are the same struggles that everyday working families are struggling. And I don't feel that we've had a true champion on any of those issues. Our families have continued to be left behind in the last decades. Things have gone worse for them. And so my feel is it matters what Democrats represent us. It matters if they're willing to stick up for immigrants and not just sit on the sidelines. I was pissed off earlier this last year in 2019 when the talk about kids being in cages. We can't afford to have folks standing on the sidelines or silent when these types of inhumane acts are happening in our country. It is unacceptable. We need to stand up for the most vulnerable. And that's the kind of representative I'm going to be. I'm not going to do what is comfortable for me. I'm going to do what our working families in this valley deserve. And if we begin to peel the onion on issues that impact this valley, Jim has not been there for working families.
That was Esmeralda Soria, candidate for the 16th congressional seat. Since we recorded that interview earlier this month, her opponent, incumbent Jim Costa, released another TV ad. This one shows clips of Soria endorsing Costa from past races. I spoke with the congressman about the commercial, but first he discussed his track record of securing funding to address homelessness.
Well, I think the nature of homelessness in our society today is of epidemic proportions in many regions of the country, and certainly here in California. And I lament that the HUD housing secretary and this president has not done more to address this issue. We in Congress have moved legislation out of the House that would provide additional funding, only to never see the light of day in Mitch McConnell's Senate. We have had some success in increasing VASH vouchers for veterans. They estimate that in California today alone, that on a given night, maybe 16,000 plus or minus of the homelessness are veterans, men and women who served our country and have come back and to find themselves in a bad way. But I think a strategy not only includes federal support for state and local efforts, but I think it's a strategy that not only has to focus on the shelter, but it has to focus on an important pillar of funding for mental health issues, for substance abuse issues, including alcoholism and post-traumatic stress syndrome. Because if you don't treat the underlying causes of homelessness, then simply shelter alone will not allow people to get back on their feet so that they can move in a condition where they can regain their dignity and be able to become functioning members of our society again.
In the past, you've called for bipartisan solutions to fix the immigration system.
Yes.
I'm wondering, given the state of divisiveness that you alluded to in your last answer, is this still a possibility?
Yes. But with the horrific policy of this administration, it's not easy. But let me tell you, I've supported comprehensive immigration reform since I first came to Congress. And we came very close in 2013 with a bipartisan bill that came out of the Senate 68-32. And there were 180 of us Democrats and probably 60 Republicans that would have voted for it if Speaker Boehner at that point had had the political courage to bring it up. And most of these immigration issues would have been dealt with. It was a legal path to citizenship, not amnesty. and it had a host of provisions that dealt with the Dreamers. I supported the Dream Act. That's another bill that we've sent over to the Senate that has not seen the light of day. I've met with Dreamers and DACA folks here and over the last 5-6 years. The Hispanic Caucus, of which I'm a member, has made this our number one, our number two, and our number three priorities. And when the 2013 bill failed, we pushed President Obama, the Hispanic Caucus. We had numerous meetings in the old executive office building with the president and others to use his executive authority, which resulted in DACA and DAPA. Now this president wants to dismantle that. Last year, we had some limited success that may provide us an opportunity this year for legal status for farm workers called the Farm Modernization Workforce Act. And my friend Bill Lofgren and I worked together on this with Jimmy Panetta and Congressman Cox and others. And we got Dan Newhouse from Washington State, Republican. And we produced a bipartisan bill that could affect over 800,000 farm workers in this country, of which almost 300,000 are here in California. And it basically says if they've worked in agriculture, either seasonally or year-round, over the last 2 years, more than 150 hours, they could qualify for legal status for 5 years. And then if they did everything proper, at the end of 5 years, they could apply for a green card and then ultimately citizenship. This may be a vehicle if, and we just had a meeting last week with our bipartisan group to figure out how we can get some Republicans and Democrats together, as we were able to do in the House, and move that forward.
So a big cornerstone of your campaign and your campaigns in the past has been your track record on water. Now, some of your critics would point to the hundreds of communities in California, many of which are here in the Central Valley, that aren't without access to safe drinking water. And some would claim that you haven't focused enough on that issue. What would be your response to that?
Well, I have worked on comprehensive efforts to use all the water tools in our water management toolbox for clean drinking water, for water supply for our farms and farm communities, and to provide a balance for our environmental restoration. I carried the legislation with Senator Feinstein in 2008 and 2009 for the San Joaquin River restoration, also for the San Joaquin River Parkway. But in addition to that, we have communities throughout the valley, and I'm working closely with Governor Newsom and Congressman Cox to provide a new program separate from the Clean Drinking Water Act, which we are also looking at modifying, to provide more funding for our small communities. A lot of the challenges, some of these communities are not even incorporated, so they don't have the resources to apply for a grant, or they don't have the hookups or the connections to create a system that you would have in a city like you have here in Fresno. And the smaller cities don't have the resources. So our combination of a strategy with the $350 million that Governor Gavin Newsom came up with last year, combined with Congressman Cox and my efforts, we hope provide some of these smaller communities the ability, and we guesstimate it's 200,000-300,000 people at least that live in small communities or non-incorporated areas that really, you know, like East Porterville, like Planada, La Grande, where we need to create a water system. I worked years ago in Lanier for a water system there by Riverdale, and we got it funded, we got it built, and less than a year after it was in operation, they had to close it because they couldn't pay to keep it operating. So it's a challenge that is significant. I've been engaged with this as I have been with other water-related issues. We've got a serious groundwater recharge efforts that in some of these wide areas in which some of that farm agricultural area is going to be very difficult to provide a water supply for in the next 10, 15 years as we try to get our overdraft in balance. So these are a host of efforts that we are engaged in, and I have brought together both state and federal water agencies to address both our clean drinking water needs, our reliable supply for water for our agriculture, and to balance our environmental needs.
So your campaign has aired two television ads that have drawn a lot of attention. The first of those ads attacked your opponent, Esmeralda Soria, on a number of issues, including a statement that she made that she lives paycheck to paycheck. Now, she has been upfront about the six-figure student loan debt that she incurred in law school that she's paying back. It's something that is certainly relatable to a lot of people, given the rising cost of higher education. I'd like to give you an opportunity to defend your inclusion of that in that particular television ad.
Well, that opponent has made a lot of false claims about my record over the last 6 months. And both of those commercials were fact-checked by the Fresno Bee GV Wire. I'm very careful when you produce an ad like that, that you can support it with the facts. Not just the fact-checking that we do, but third-party verifiers that validify that. And my opponent may have lived paycheck to paycheck at some point in her life. I lived paycheck to paycheck at a point in my life. But if you're making $115,000 a year, you're no longer living paycheck to paycheck. I think that it's just important that the facts are clear. As far as the endorsement ad, that's in her own words. You know, 18 months ago, I haven't changed from 18 months ago when I was standing up for working people of our valley, when I was the strongest advocate for the people of our valley, when I got the $16 million to provide the opening of the Fulton Street Mall. And I was very proud of that endorsement then, along with many other endorsements that include the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the attorney general, who was just here yesterday on my behalf. And the governor was here last fall, both United States senators, Senator Ana Caballero and Senator Melissa Hurtado, a broad reach of relationships and partnerships that I've had. And I was proud of the councilwoman's endorsement. I supported her, and she supported me. I haven't changed in the last 8 months since she decided to run against me. And I think it's nice to make sure that people understand that. And to add a little humor, I think, is also people, I think, get tired of all the campaigns with that don't have at least a little humor. And they're all accurate. The ads are accurate.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The San Joaquin Valley is one of the two most polluted air basins in the country. That's why in 2018, two communities here, Fresno and Shafter, were chosen as part of AB 617, an ambitious state law that enables community members to get involved in cleaning up the air. Now, 18 months into that process, FM89's Carrie Klein checks in on how it's going with Nyamin Martinez of the Central California Environmental Justice Network, Janet Gardner of Caglia Environmental, and Jonathan London, a professor of human ecology at UC Davis.
So first, there are some bureaucratic terms that I wanted to kind of get out of the way and make sure that we keep straight. There's the State Air Regulating Agency, known as CARB. There's the local air district, which is just here in the valley. And then there are these community-level steering committees, which is where we're going to focus here. So, Nyamin, I'd like to start with you. You're one of the environmental justice representatives on Fresno's steering committee. Can you start by telling us how community members were brought into AB 617 and how this process was different from other air improvement initiatives?
Well, at the forefront of the implementation of AB 617 was the idea that they wanted involvement from community members since the inception, meaning not just in public meetings where they could get feedback of the result. But the idea was to invite community members, invite agent advocates, invite business representatives to apply to be part of this steering committee. Ever since, we have been meeting mostly once a month, but during the summer, it was more than that. And again, it was an opportunity for all the stakeholders involved to have a say as of what the air monitoring plan was going to look like, where we wanted the monitors to be, but at the same time, what were the strategies that we think were supposed to be included in the community emission reduction plan in order to cut down the emissions.
And so the steering committee that you're a member of, well, and there are steering committees for every one of the 10 communities chosen for AB 617. And so the one that you're involved in here was working together with the air district to come up with these plans.
So you're right. There were 10 communities for the year one implementation of AB 617. Fresno was one of those. One of the unique elements of our committee is that it was, as I know, the largest of all the 10 communities. Most of the other steering committees were mostly 20 people. Our steering committee at once was maybe over 40 members. Over the months, of course, the participation kind of declined, of course, meeting fatigue, if you will. But there was still a consistent number of a variety of stakeholders who were still attending meetings on a consistent basis, both representing the residents who live there, the EJ advocates, but also some business representatives.
So a lot of enthusiasm here in Fresno, especially.
Yes.
Okay. And Janet, you're a business representative on Fresno Steering Committee. So this committee has been meeting for close to 18 months now. You know, in that time, what are some of the initiatives the committee has come up with to improve air monitoring and air quality here in this area?
So on the initiatives and what they were looking at is some of the causes of the air pollution, since they already had some data, and then resolutions and how to improve those and where good monitoring locations could be to further add to their data on what is really happening and what do we need to do to clean it up. And the initiatives that they have going forward were, what pieces of equipment? Is it the highway corridor? Is it the diesel trucks? Is it lawnmowers? Is it charbroil grillers? What things are causing the most issues that we can hit and start knocking those air emissions down and making it a better environment for people that live there, people that work there, and the whole community? Realizing one of the major intersections in this one happens to be North 99, the 180, where the rail station also is. And that's a heavy area on trucks, on trains, on traffic. And that is a very heavy area where at certain times, if there's a train going across and all the trucks and traffic is stopped, you're going to see that the emissions are going to go up if trucks are idling. So there's already some things in there, cutting down on truck traffic trips, and a recommendation from the committee to look at rerouting traffic farther away from the where the communities and the homes are and away from the schools. So a reroute of those, because there was already some known knowledge. It's not necessarily fully complete, and that's why we wanted the monitors to do some more monitoring to find out where are these heavy hit areas.
Okay, that's great. And so last week, state air regulators actually approved this plan here in Fresno, a similar one from Shafter also, but not without considerable discussion. So, Naimeen, why don't you start by telling me, I mean, how has the environmental justice community responded to this full plan here in Fresno?
Well, we have also diverse opinions, even within the environmental justice advocates. There was one group who was asking for CARB to reject the plan and take it back to the drawing board. Then there were some of us, including my organization, that were asking for a conditional approval. And then there were others that said, it's okay, let's just move on. So even within our EJ advocates, we didn't agree 100%. However, what was really positive is that at last meeting in Chapter, where they approved the two plans, Chapter and Fresno, there was a really constructive discussion as of what things can were okay from the plan that was presented, but what things can be improved. And then there was an agreement of how to do that through the implementation plan. So some of the specific things that were added in the resolution that, that the CARB board voted on were, for example, not only saying, yes, the residents had requested for a rerouting of diesel trucks away from their neighborhoods, but there was no funding allocated for that particular strategy. After the Thursday meeting, what happened is that the air district agreed to include funding for that strategy. Another thing was, for example, to really consider other recommendations from the steering committee when they were going to be reallocating the funding that is available, because there was a plan, right, that the Air District approved in September. But then in October, the steering committee met again, and they were giving different suggestions. For example, maybe let's cut down the money that we had allocated for locomotives and maybe put more money towards replacing school buses. Mm. So according to the resolution that was approved Thursday, the recommendations made by the steering committee are going to be taken seriously, if you will, by the Air District, and make sure that that funding goes towards those directed priorities. I mean, I think that definitely we walk away from with a stronger plan and implementation plan, and that we have very set parameters of what are we going to working on in the next 6 months, as the California Resources Board agreed to come back, not to Shafter, but to Fresno, to hear back from the steering committee and from the Air District, what is the progress made so far in the implementation.
Wow. Okay. So there was a lot of really getting into the nitty gritty at this meeting last Thursday of, you know, how much money are we putting in each actual pot here, and which of those will actually be the most valuable to community members.
Yes, because I think that another unique element of this plan was that they really wanted to include mitigation strategies so that residents don't have to wait, you know, for 5 more years for the air to be cleaner. So some of those mitigation strategies include, for example, having filters installed in public schools in the area of AB617, having funding allocated to plant trees as vegetative barriers for this pollution, among other things that residents consider that was something that could be done right away while we wait for the emissions to go down.
I think this is one of the things that all of us really wanted to know, was that there's going to be some flexibility within it, such that as we go down the line and this information is being gathered and we see what's working and what's not working, is that we can make adjustments to make it work instead of being locked in to, no, you have to follow this, otherwise we have to open the whole thing up again.
And Janet, you know, when it comes to kind of the business side again of kind of viewing this plan, did you find that those stakeholders shared kind of the same qualms and were looking for the same conditions that the Environmental Justice Group was looking for in this final plan?
Were we looking for the same things? Well, we want to be able to move forward, and business wants to take a stake and wants to make sure our surrounding community, and we want to support them. We are a business, though. We are not a nonprofit. So there are certain things we have to do to ensure the future of the business. We can't just make open space and parks. Do we want to include that? Yes. Do we want to do vegetative barriers? Yes. There's certain other things that we do want to do. We would like to move one of our warehouses over. So getting down into the nitty-gritty, the biggest benefit that we've seen as a business is just sitting down at the table and having the communication with the community, with the environmental justice, and listening and having that understanding. And it has been humbling, and it has been a really good experience. But I think working together moving forward, we have to continue to listen to each other and to work together.
Yeah, well, and now, Jonathan, I'd like to turn to you. So you've been studying the AB617 process throughout the state, not just here in Fresno or Shafter. Your research also was partially supported by CARB. So, you know, from what you can tell, has AB617 achieved its goal of being inclusive and engaging the community perhaps more than other air regulations have?
I think AB617 has made some really important strides in setting up more inclusive processes. There's these community steering committees, as there are in Fresno and Shafter and 8 other communities throughout the state, are very diverse in terms of their representation with, you know, community residents and organizations and businesses and local governments and other key stakeholders. So that's been very positive. They've done a lot of work to try to get those to be broadly representative of the communities in terms of, you know, demographic backgrounds, and districts have done a pretty good job of that. I think where it's been a bit more challenged has been some of the issues that Naimeen mentioned about falling off of resident engagement, and I think that's not just been the case in the Valley, but in other parts of the state. And I think some of that is it's a very long and intensive process. Some of the steering committee members in some of the places have not received stipends, and other places they have. Mm-hmm. With lower income members, that's challenging to give that amount of time. The work has been quite technically complex with air quality monitoring and some of the science. And the steering committee members, as I've seen, have really devoted a lot of time to understanding those issues and have become quite sophisticated. But it just takes a lot of time to get that kind of level of engagement, and that's not easy to sustain. So if this is going to be a long-term sustained process, not just in these, pilot communities, but throughout the state, there's going to need to be some more effort put into coming up with a solution that really can engage people in a long-term way. One other issue of inclusiveness is there's only 10 communities selected in the first year and now just 3 in the second year. So it's not nearly the coverage that's needed across the state to address the communities that have these really significant air quality problems. So ideally, there could be some of these lessons learned that could be adapted by other air districts elsewhere in the state, or just the same districts with more communities within their territories. So that's another important part of the inclusiveness.
Yeah, and then what about the actual effectiveness of the law? I mean, do you think it really will be transformative? Will it improve air quality, in these communities?
So I look at the issues of transformation in two ways. So one is transforming the process, which we've talked about. And I do think that there's a really different way of doing air quality management that's brought down not just from the state to the regional level, like the air districts, but also now from the regional to the community scale. And that's really innovative and really unprecedented to some large degree. And so if that kind of model can be really fully established and resourced, I think that can be really, really powerful. In terms of the impact of actually improving air quality in the communities, I think that it really has a lot of possibility to do that. And I would say to go further to then address health disparities, which ultimately, we're concerned about. But I think that's going to need continued effort by the districts and really for the community organizations and residents to hold the districts accountable to make sure that they continue to prioritize these communities, since they have a lot of other things that they need to do. But this needs to continue to be front and center of their work if there is going to be that kind of improvement in these communities. They're also going to need to involve a lot of other agencies, the city and the county, because they deal with land use. Air District doesn't deal with land use. And their transportation districts and school districts, and in the coastal areas, there's the ports. So the air districts themselves are crucial and central, but for the work to be transformative, it has to transform the whole network of organizations that are ultimately affecting air quality. And it's also really going to need, again, resources from the state to make sure that the districts have the funds they need, that there's funding for community to be able to participate. So there's strong responsibility at the state level as well.
I would like to add to the question about effectiveness. I think, we don't know, right? We're starting the implementation right now, so that's a question for 5 years from now. However, mm-hmm. One thing that the blueprint, which is really the framework for the implementation of AB 617, calls for is having benchmarks or emission reduction targets, so that we can say, this was the baseline and we were able to cut it by this much mm-hmm. for every strategy. Some of our strategies that were part of the SERP had those targets, but not every single one. So that was one of the asks that a lot of us were still making at the meeting last week, is that in order for us to really measure the effectiveness of all these strategies, we need to have a way to assess what the progress has been made. And that there was the explanation that they are trying to still figure out how to quantify the missions for every single strategy, that the idea is that as information becomes available, they will be plugging in that data so that we can all have a way of measuring the progress made. But definitely we're in the beginning of the implementation phase. So that's a really good question for 5 years. And, you know, I guess we will have to see milestones that we can achieve in 6 months and 12 months so that we don't wait until 5 years from now.
Yeah, there needs to be some kind of metrics that show what the progress is, because we need to be able to identify the things that aren't working and shift those funds and those resources to things that will work. And that's one of the key things that I think came up at Thursday's meeting, is we need some flexibility in this, because if we're going down the line and then seeing through metrics, through results, that it's not working, we don't want to keep putting money into what's not working. We want something that's going to work and alternatives to get there. Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I will look forward to getting an update later on. Naimeen Martinez, Janet Gardner, and Jonathan London, thank you all so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And now, the weekend. Stand-up comic Paula Poundstone is coming to the Tower Theater in Fresno on Saturday. You may know her as a panelist on the NPR quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but did you know she loves exercise? When it's over. And she's even written a book on happiness. Well, sort of. FM89's news director Alice Daniel recently caught up with Poundstone.
Welcome to Valley Edition, Paula. Before we get to your stand-up show in Fresno on Saturday, let's talk Wait, Wait. Is it as fun as it seems? Do you prepare for it at all?
I do. First of all, yes, it's a blast. You know, I sit in a chair and think of things that might be funny, and I say them along with other people who are doing the same. It's very fun. I do prepare in that I look at the news ahead of time and the bluff story we write ahead of time. But outside of that, I mean, I don't prepare jokes. There's nothing stopping me from doing that. I guess I'm just not responsible enough.
Well, your humor is so deadpan, and you don't laugh at your own jokes. And I wonder, how do you do that?
Because I do, quite honestly.
Do you?
Yeah. Yeah. Not always, but sometimes. Sometimes things just strike me, I think of something quickly, and I laugh at it because I thought it was funny, too. But not always. Sometimes.
So if you were alone on a deserted island, would you be able to entertain yourself with a monologue, or do you need an audience?
No, I would need an audience. You know, if I was alone on a desert island, the first 2 days would go great. First 2 days would be fantastic. It would be a dream come true. But by the third day, I would miss my best friend, who is the audience.
Okay, so you'd have a break for 2 days, and then you'd go downhill.
Yeah, exactly. Rapidly, it would be, my gosh.
So if you hadn't made it as a comic, what would you be doing now?
I'm not sure I'd be alive, but if I was alive, I'd be an incredibly good table busser.
So would you say comedy saved you then? You said you're not sure you would be alive.
I think that it is a very, I mean, not from anything in particular other than deep depression, it's a very uplifting, healing practice. It just is. I know from audience members who come up and talk to me that it has that effect on them as an audience. And certainly, being in a room full of people who've come out to laugh for the night is, just the best job ever.
Well, in 2017, you released your second book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And you were a guinea pig in a series of thoroughly unscientific experiments. What did you learn? And do you think much about happiness?
Well, I do. I mean, it's occurring to me recently that I'm not sure where anybody ever got the idea that you were supposed to be, happy, like some huge percentage of the time. I mean, it just doesn't seem that's how. It's like what your mother used to say, it's just not how life is designed. which is there's a good deal of struggle involved on every level, you know, struggle to sort of survive physically and, you know, a job and that sort of thing, and put food on the table if you have a table. And then there's the, you know, and then there's the relationship part, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I did find out through the through my experiments, you know, physical exercise is really important. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of it every day. Here's the problem with the, you know, with, you know, like rigorous physical exercise. It really does make you feel better. Here's the trick. It doesn't make you feel better while you're doing it.
Right.
Which is why it's this very elusive, you know, form of emotional well-being. Because the truth is, while you're doing it, it really sucks.
Right.
It's
especially
awful.
Like if you're running. That's horrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can't run. I really can. I work out. In fact, I started working out with this Taekwondo self-defense guy. I started doing it for the purposes of researching for my book. And then when I was done with that experiment, I quit because I had to go on to the next experiment and I had to isolate the variables. But years later, I went back to the guy and I've been with him ever since. And yesterday I did, I don't even know how many push-ups, and today I'm sore and stiff, but I, at the same time, I have an elevated glow about me. It's like the two things don't go together. You're either sore because you never move, or you're sore because you moved. Those are your two choices. I opt for the second.
So the takeaway from your book is laugh a lot and exercise, knowing that at some point you'll reap the benefits.
Those are two important things, I think. There are others, mm-hmm. but those are two important things. And frankly, I was hoping to dispel it. I really didn't want the answer to be physical exercise. I mean, is there anything more smug than a blonde woman in yoga pants? No.
So let's turn to your stand-up show that's coming to Fresno. You compare it to an arcade game where you stand inside a booth and they blow money around. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's sort of what the inside of my brain is like, I think. You know those arcade games where you stand inside a glass booth and they blow paper money around you, and whatever you can catch, you can keep. And I feel like that's sort of how my brain is. You know, I've been doing this job for 41 years, so I have somewhere rattling around in my brain. There is, in fact, 41 years of material. I don't really know what I'm going to say when. There are probably on a given night about a third of what I say on a good night, and I like to think some are, probably about a third of what I say is unique to just that night. I've never said it before, and I'll never say it again. It just had to do with the interaction with the crowd that night. But my favorite part of that is the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? I like talking to the audience, and I ask individuals questions. And from there, I really let that be the thing that sets my sails. So it may be that in that moment, there's a piece of material flying around in the glass booth, and I grab it in my brain and say that piece of material from somewhere within that 41 years. And it's just as possible that, I say stuff that, I don't know, just occurred to me in that moment. Like any conversation you have, I mean, we repeat things all the time. We say things from, you know, that we've said before. Sometimes we say them to the same person, unfortunately. But in conversation, we repeat stories, and then we say stuff that, that's new, and then we say stuff that talks about current events. You know, that's sort of my act as a big conversation.
So it's not a bad way to operate in the world as long as funny things keep coming in. Does your mind ever go blank?
Yes.
And what do you do then?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, as I say, I got 41 years of material somewhere. I mean, I have, but there are times where, I just stand there for a second and I'm like, uh-oh. And usually given a few more seconds, I pick up the tools and keep going. But there are here and there moments where I'm just like, I got no idea what to say right now.
So when did you first know you were funny?
Well, the first sentence of the last paragraph of the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher in May of 1965 says, "I have enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities." So I have to assume that in May of 1965, I was doing, you know, a tight five on Play-Doh or something. I have that letter still.
I was going to ask you.
I do have that letter, and I also have it enlarged and framed. In addition to the fact that, I mean, I can still recall really enjoying the response of laughter when I was little, or enjoying just hearing laughter, even if it had nothing to do with me at all. It definitely influenced me, I think, that an adult liked something that I did. But I think one of the things about Mrs. Bump's letter was there was no qualifications to it. It was just that she had enjoyed it.
That's something, it's good to carry something like that with you your whole life.
It is kind of nice. And then you think about, you know, the shit things that teachers have said to you in your lifetime, too.
Of course.
Or that people who influence you or people that you looked up to have said. And, of course, you know, no life can bat 1,000.
Right. There's plenty of those. So one last question.
Well, I was also a pain in the neck in school, but in kindergarten I had just gotten started.
So as a woman, what advice would you give to young women trying to break into the stand-up comedy world?
Pay as little attention to the fact that you're a woman as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a genderless job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are jobs where you could argue, you know, like tennis, you know, maybe the women shouldn't play against the men. Maybe that would be an unfair, maybe men have, you know, some sort of possibility of muscular development that women don't have. I'm not certain. Billie Jean King did, you know, who did she play? I can't even think now. Bobby Riggs. But, you know, being a woman in comedy should neither hold you back nor move you forward. You should just be a good comic. I was, years ago, California was lucky enough to have two women senators. We still do. We have Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. But years ago, for the first time we ever had two women senators, it was Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. And I'm a big admirer of both of those senators, but they did during that election, during that campaign, they both used to flit around the stage talking about the year of the woman, which always troubled me. And I told Barbara Boxer so. I'm not sure she understood why I objected to it, but I just, you know, the idea that women get a year is just silly, the year of the woman. I don't want a year. I don't want a Tuesday afternoon. I just want equality, and then we don't have to talk about it all the time. It's just there.
Well, that's a good way to end this interview. Paula Poundstone performs at the Tower Theater this Saturday at 7:30. Thanks so much for joining us, Paula.
Thanks a lot. It was nice talking with you.
You too. Take care.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You could also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.